All right. We come now to the climax of the chapter, which is female orgasm. This picture is showing you what happens during sexual intercourse, which can lead to orgasm. And orgasm evolved, of course, as a reward. Otherwise, we would be much less likely to go through with all this stuff. And so, because of orgasm, mating occurs a lot more often, and that is obviously evolutionarily adaptive because it creates new organisms. Well, the purpose there, therefore, is to cause fertilization to happen, or to make it more likely. Although, of course, you can go through with all this without any intent of creating a zygote. Anyway, during female arousal, well, actually before arousal, in the unstimulated state, notice that the uterus is positioned like I told you it was earlier, kind of drapes over the top of the urinary bladder. Consider her in the anatomical position, which would be standing up. It comes forward and lies superior to the urinary bladder. And also the vaginal canal is fairly constricted because at the moment it's serving no purpose. But excitement, sexual excitement, changes that. Notice the drastic change in the position of the uterus, and also the fact that the vaginal canal has dilated at its uterine end, the end that toward the cervix of the uterus. It's gotten a little wider in preparation for receiving the penis. And natural lubrication is being added because there is transudation, which is kind of like sweating, only it's not sweat, and it's not through glands, it's just cells. I mean, the epithelial cells, the epithelium itself is releasing moisture. And there is also vasocongestion occurring in the labia minora. Vasocongestion simply refers to a all of a sudden rush of blood through those vessels, which makes them more voluminous. It's adding volume, so they become larger and therefore may protrude beyond the labia majora, which are usually hiding them. And they also change color because of that blood supply through them. So that's excitement, and then that's followed by plateau. Just before orgasm is plateau, and notice that the uterus has moved again. The contractions of muscles in the vaginal wall serve as stimulation for the penis that is that has entered by this point, and the engorgement because of blood is maximal at this point. Now, assuming that ejaculation by the male has happened, there's a pool of semen right there at the end of the vaginal canal, right next to the cervix, and if the female undergoes orgasm, then there's a drastic change in the uterine. Well, there's multiple contractions, but the uterus actually moves several times toward the end of the vaginal canal and kind of kisses the pool of semen, assuming it's there. And this makes it more likely that some number of millions of sperm in that semen will enter into the uterus itself, which has to happen, of course, if fertilization is going to take place. Now, it doesn't mean it's necessary, because these, you know, semen basically anywhere in the vagina could actually end up in a pregnancy because they swim so well. But this is just the contractive action of the uterus facilitates that semen getting into the uterus itself. In any case, though, the sperm have to enter through the cervix, swim up through the body of the uterus into the uterine tubes, and then that's where usually along the way, if an egg has been ovulated at the right time, the sperm will encounter it. Most of the time, of course, that doesn't happen because ovulation only occurs once a month, basically. And so the vast majority of copulatory events don't end in pregnancy. Also, even if the couple is trying for pregnancy and fertilization does occur, quite often something goes wrong in the process and there's a spontaneous abortion that the woman doesn't even realize she's ever been was pregnant to begin with. So things have to go just right, actually, for pregnancy to happen. But it certainly does happen, obviously. Well, anyway, orgasm in the female, fundamental difference. Well, first of all, what's the same thing about orgasm in a male and a female is that it's an event in the brain, right? Orgasm is a sensation. So it's, you know, it's brought on by things that are happening at the genitalia, and that might be where some of the feeling is during orgasm, but that's really neural activity that we're experiencing. One big difference, though, and I told you this before in the male chapter, is that males become refractory. Refractoriness refers to a period of being unable to be stimulated for a certain amount of time. So after a male orgasm, there has to be a rest period, basically, before even an erection can be achieved again, let alone another orgasm, which in a male, orgasm accompanies ejaculation. Females have orgasm whether they ejaculate or not, but there is female ejaculation in a certain number of women that is really just a rapid release of fluid from paraurethral glands that are, as far as development is concerned, those paraurethral glands are homologous to the prostate in males, which, of course, during emission and ejaculation in a male is contributory to the semen, which is ejaculated. But in any case, another difference is in between males and females is that there is no refractoriness in females, which is why females can experience multiple orgasms successively without the recovery period in between. But however many orgasms there are, after orgasm there is resolution, which is basically a resetting. Everything goes back to the normal positions, normal blood flow, a stoppage of the secretions for moistening and so on. Everything's back to unstimulated state. Okay, 16. Three different traces on this graph, you see, different colors, for three different major hormones. Now, these aren't the only hormones, but these are the biggies. And so this is relative hormone levels versus time, basically, but time being how many weeks into the pregnancy or gestation. So we talked a little bit before about the fact that after ovulation, some hormones are released by what remains of the follicle, although it's not a follicle at that point, right? Because ovulation gets rid of the oocyte, and without an oocyte, it can't be called an ovule. What do we call that instead? what do we call, instead of a follicle, what is it called? Corpus luteum, right. The corpus luteum is the rest of the follicle after the egg and cumulus oophorus have been removed. So anyway, we talked about that being now an endocrine structure, right? It's producing hormones. And we specifically talked about progesterone being secreted from it. And progesterone, remember, is named for the fact that it prepares the uterus for pregnancy. It promotes gestation, pregnancy. So that corpus luteum is operating as an endocrine organ every cycle, whether pregnancy occurs or not. I mean, whether conception occurs or not, fertilization. And if it doesn't, if fertilization does not occur, then that corpus luteum does not have a very long life, right? Just several days, and then it stops abruptly secreting its progesterone, and that's the drop in that progesterone, as we already talked about, is what actually hormonally signals that there's no use in continuing to keep this endometrial lining thick and nutritive for something that doesn't exist, right? So that's the signal to say, okay, time to kill that functional layer, starve it by cutting off the blood supply to those spiral arteries so that all those cells just die and get removed as menstrual fluid. And then you start over another cycle. And what does that corpus luteum, after it stops its useful lifetime of secreting progesterone, what does it develop into? A what? Well, what does corpus luteum mean? No? Yellow body. But what it becomes is a white body, and what's the phrase for that? Corpus albicans, yes. And so that corpus albicans, that's just trash as far as usefulness is concerned. And a new corpus luteum will be produced the next period in the other ovary, usually, when whichever follicle graduates from that class releases its egg, and that will be the new corpus luteum. So that just keeps going over and over. If conception does occur, though, if fertilization is successful, then the corpus luteum is allowed to, well, it's kept alive for much longer so that it can continue to produce progesterone much longer. But what is it that actually signals the corpus luteum to keep living? Well, it makes sense for that signal, which is a hormone, to come directly from the structure that wouldn't exist if fertilization did not occur. And what is that structure? What structure doesn't exist unless there has been implantation? Placenta, exactly. So the placenta is an important organ. Like I said, it's kind of half and half the property of the fetus and the, well, it's not called the fetus until weeks later, but the conceptus, which could be used at any stage, is the name for the new human to come. Half its property and half the mother's property. It's a combination of tissues. And it's an important organ for delivery of nutrients and oxygen via blood to the developing embryo and later fetus, but also removal of wastes, right? The fetus is not breathing. It's not, its lungs are developing, but it's not using its lungs, right? So the oxygen has to come from the maternal blood, and the nutrients do as well because the fetus isn't eating while it's in there. So that connection point between the two circulatory systems, the fetal circulatory system and the mother's circulatory system, is the placenta. But the placenta, besides doing that job or those jobs, the placenta is also an important endocrine structure. It doesn't exist at all, though, unless pregnancy has occurred, which is why it makes sense to have that structure produce a signal to tell the corpus luteum, stay alive, I'm pregnant. And that's exactly what the placenta does. Whatever color this is, it looks gray to me here, but I think it's a different color, probably on a different screen. Anyway, the tall peak is labeled as human chorionic gonadotropin. Now, the chorion is one of the extra embryonic membranes in vertebrates. So it's part of the placenta. That's why it's called that. Human, obviously. And gonadotropin, we've already talked about why things are called gonadotropins. Well, that just simply means that it acts on a gonad, right? In a female, that's the ovary. But specifically, what human chorionic gonadotropin acts on as its target tissue is the corpus luteum. And so this is the signal that tells the corpus luteum, don't die as soon as you normally would, stay alive longer, and keep producing your progesterone because pregnancy actually has occurred. A very reliable signal, because the only tissue that produces human chorionic gonadotropin is the placenta, and it doesn't exist unless pregnancy is there. So a very reliable signal that pregnancy actually did occur. And that's why we see that surge early on, because early on, even though the placenta will eventually produce progesterone itself, and as you see also estradiol, which is the major estrogen, it takes a while for the developing placenta to get to the point where it produces sufficient amounts of progesterone and estradiol. Therefore, it still needs the help of the corpus luteum making its own progesterone to keep that endometrial lining just right for pregnancy. All right, and so it gets that signal, it being the corpus luteum, gets the signal from the placenta in the form of human chorionic gonadotropin that it's not just an ordinary corpus luteum anymore. Now it's what's called a corpus luteum of pregnancy, which really is the same thing, it just lives longer. Okay? Now it eventually will still turn into a corpus albicans. It'll just be weeks later rather than just days later, because the human chorionic gonadotropin keeps it alive. And therefore, the progesterone keeps the endometrial lining good, but gestation or pregnancy lasts much longer than the lifespan of even a corpus luteum of pregnancy. That doesn't matter, though, because by the time the corpus luteum finally does die, or corpus luteum of pregnancy, by the time it eventually dies, the cells of the placenta have taken over the job of secreting the progesterone. So the progesterone level, even though it's shown as rising later on here, that's just progesterone from the placenta itself. If you looked at it in the body, it would be pretty constant. It's just that it's a different thing taking over the job of secreting it. What did I want to say else about this? Oh, also, since this is such a reliable signal of pregnancy, this is exactly what home pregnancy tests test for. It's basically just an ELISA test, which is a test you can use to see whether a certain material or chemical is present in a sample. So you can use ELISA for just about anything. It uses antibodies to detect something. In the case of a pregnancy test, it's just an ELISA that's looking for human chorionic gonadotropin, which should not be there at all unless the woman is pregnant. So the chance of a false positive, meaning a positive indication of pregnancy when you're actually not pregnant, is very, very low, because there should always be, unless it's contaminated somehow, it's effectively a zero chance of being a false positive. Now, you can have a false negative, meaning that the test will say you're not pregnant when you actually are. That's pretty rare, though, too, because these ELISA tests are cheap and very, very reliable. Anyway, that's what it's directly testing for, HCG, or human chorionic gonadotropin. 17 is a tabular rundown of the hormones of pregnancy. A lot of this we've already talked about. By the way, I didn't say much about estrogens. There are different kinds of estrogens, but estradiol is the most potent form. Even though there are other estrogens that are in greater concentrations, estradiol is the main one as far as doing its job. And this stimulates fetal tissue growth, as you see. Enlargement of the uterus. The uterus has to get much bigger than it is in the non-pregnant form in order to handle what will be something taking up most of the volume of the abdominal pelvic cavity by the time it takes up much more room than the abdominal pelvic cavity's normal volume. The woman's abdomen gets much bigger, as you already know. But it also, estrogens prepare for parturition by softening the pubic symphysis, which is the fibrocartilage joint between the two pubes, where the two pubic bones come together in the front, which is the pubic symphysis. Any symphysis, remember, is a joint consisting of fibrocartilage. That usually is a pretty immobile joint, but it gets softened up so that the two pubes can separate from each other a little bit to widen the birth canal. Birth canal, by the way, the hole in that girdle, the hole in that pelvic girdle that you see on a skeleton, that's a major way that you can sex a skeleton, right? A male doesn't have to have a birth canal, so the coccyx curves way in there. It's not in the way of anything. You're not going to put a head through there. But the head has to pass through that pelvic girdle in the female, which is why it's more open. Well, it becomes even more open during pregnancy, and especially late pregnancy, of course, because estrogens soften up that pubic symphysis, and also the sacroiliac joints become less stiff as well. We talked about progesterone enough and human chorionic gonadotropin. Human chorionic somatomammotropin is really better understood in other mammals because it's the major hormone responsible for getting lactation going. But that's not what it does in humans. And we're not sure exactly why there's so much of it produced in humans. But one thing it does is kind of act like a growth hormone in its glucose-sparing effect. Glucose sparing refers to telling cells of the body not to use glucose as the primary fuel and use something else instead, like you do in times of stress, for instance. Well, here you're saving it basically for the fetus, which is not eating, and telling the rest of the body to use other sources, like fat, for instance. Pituitary thyrotropin simply means thyroid. What is another name for thyrotropin? What?
Thyroid hormone.
No, not thyroid hormone. Thyroid hormone is produced where? In the thyroid.
Oh.
What is a thyrotropin? What does tropin mean? What's a gonadotropin? Yes, it's a hormone. But why? What classifies it as a gonadotropin? It acts on the gonads. So what's a thyrotropin? Yes, it acts on the thyroid. So what's another name for thyrotropin? Thyroid stimulating hormone. Right? Thyroid-stimulating hormone is a thyrotropin. So when they say pituitary thyrotropin, they're referring to the thyroid-stimulating hormone that we've already talked about that's released from the pituitary of the mother. Well, she releases a lot more during pregnancy than she does during non-pregnant lifetime. But there's also human chorionic thyrotropin released by the placenta. They both are the same chemical, but they're coming from two places at once. And so a pregnant woman has a much higher metabolic rate, which is what thyroid hormone does, right? It increases metabolism. She has a much higher metabolism than a non-pregnant woman, than she had when she was non-pregnant. So when you're saying she's eating for two, I mean, that is literally true because she has another individual inside her. But she's not only having to build up new material to create this fetus, and that in the material comes from the food we eat, of course. That's, we build our bodies out of the food we eat, but also all the cells of her and the fetus are running at a higher level than they would, so they're requiring more energy, not just for growth, but just for metabolism as well. And so that's why she's so voracious, will eat anything. Parathyroid hormone is important as well. Now, it's always important, as we've talked about, because it maintains calcium ion balance in the blood. But in pregnancy, that becomes more of an issue because the fetus needs to build its own... well, it's not a bony skeleton at first, but it needs a lot of calcium for itself. Once again, it's not eating. The calcium source for that, the woman's skeleton, which is a huge repository of calcium, right? So that's true whether it's a person is pregnant or not. But a pregnant woman ends up taking a withdrawal of calcium out of her calcium bank, her skeleton, much larger withdrawal during pregnancy than if not. And this is why calcium intake by the pregnant woman is so important. That should be elevated during pregnancy because she needs more calcium. Anyway, parathyroid hormone becomes more prevalent, is increased in its secretion rate during pregnancy because of that. And adrenocorticotropic hormone, we already talked about that as well. That's always important, but it becomes especially important when a fetus is being produced. Aldosterone, what do you know aldosterone as doing? What is its nickname? The what hormone? Yeah, the salt-saving hormone. So it retains sodium, right? It does that in all people, but in... increased secretion of aldosterone in a pregnant woman makes her retain more salt, right? What does that do osmotically? If the salt is kept in the blood where it would normally be put into the urine, aldosterone keeps it in the blood. What does that do as far as water is concerned? Water follows the salt, right? So water is going to be retained in the blood, increasing the blood volume. Now, in a non-pregnant woman, you wouldn't want that to happen too much, right? Because the greater blood volume would lead to too very high blood pressure, exactly. But you actually want increased blood volume in a pregnant woman, right? Because she's serving the fetus. And then relaxin, notice it promotes development of decidual cells, which I didn't even mention, but decidual cells are part of this functional layer of the endometrium, and they are responsible basically for feeding the developing conceptus, whichever stage you're talking about, whether it's embryo or fetus. By the way, it officially makes the graduation from embryo to fetus where in pregnancy? Does anyone know? It is trimester-based, yeah. Well, I mean, we roughly divide human gestation into trimesters, three-thirds, basically. But, during that first trimester, it's officially an embryo. A fetus is starting at week 9, so the first 8 weeks. I think it's 8. It's either 7 or 8, somewhere around there. You become, I think it is 8. It's embryo until then and fetus thereafter. And it's not just a name change. Embryo starts out not looking very much like a human at all, right? And drastically changes in its form. I mean, for instance, it starts with a tail. We don't have a tail by the time we're born. So it looks drastically different and undergoes an enormous actual change in its shape. But once it gets to the fetal stage, it's much smaller than it's going to be, of course, before it's born, or when it's born. But it's already in basically the shape it's going to be. It just gets bigger during the fetal stage. That's the big difference. Well, we can see a fetus that's pretty ripe in slide 18. It's not going to be there much longer. And the reason it's not going to be there much longer is because the more this thing grows, the more it stretches the uterus, of course, right? And when that gets to a critical level of stretching, especially at the fundus, which is the top part of the fetus, right? The blind-ended part. That's going to send signals via the nervous system to the brain, neural signals created by stretch receptors, that the time has come to eject the fetus. And we've already talked about, I'll go through the mechanism again, but before I do that, I just don't want to forget to mention that normally this is the situation as far as the position of the fetus, right? Most babies are born head first. Some are born breached, but most are head first. And that's really just because the head, since it's so bulbous, is kind of the best thing to use as a wedge to get things open to begin with and make it easier to slide out. You might not think that would be the best idea, though, because the head contains the most important part of the body, right, the brain, and using that as a tool to wedge open the birth canal, especially when you don't have a bony skull at that point, and therefore the brain actually can be pushed on by deformation of the head. Nevertheless, it's nice and round, it basically pushes open the birth canal in most cases. But anyway, the actual act of giving birth, which is parturition, is, at least in terms of mention in textbooks, the most famous example of positive feedback. Almost every textbook that you pick up, when it goes over positive feedback and negative feedback, you know, most feedback mechanisms are negative. Those are the only ones that are homeostatic. Most of them will give as an example of positive feedback parturition. And so what happens is once it's stretched enough, the stretch receptors send action potential or create action potentials in neurons that get propagated to the brain. And what specific part of the brain hears about this? The what? What part of the brain are those messages about the uterus being stretched sent to? It's going to be the part of the brain that responds to that message by releasing a hormone. If that makes it easier. The hypothalamus?
That's what I said.
Yes. Now, which part of the hypothalamus is actually directly connected to the pituitary? Or, I mean, which part of the pituitary is actually just an extension of the hypothalamus? The posterior pituitary, otherwise known as what? The neurohypophysis, correct. So, in the neurohypophysis, you don't have the hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal system, which is blood, right? Instead, remember, on the rear part, you have the hypothalamus, which of course is neurons. That's where cell bodies are that give rise to axons, right? A neuron has cell body and then an axon coming off of that. Well, those axons don't end in the hypothalamus like they do for the ones that trigger the portal system in front. Those axons extend down through that infundibulum, which is the stalk that connects the hypothalamus to the pituitary. And then their axon terminals make up the posterior pituitary. That's why it's called the neurohypophysis, because it's not endocrine organ. It's made up of the cell, the axon terminals of the neurons that start out in the hypothalamus. So really, it is just an extension of the hypothalamus, but we give it a different name because it's in a different position. So yes, the dendrites at the cell bodies that are up in the proper part of the hypothalamus get information in the form of neurotransmitters being released by neurons in response to action potentials that were created down at the uterus by being stretched. Those hypothalamic neurons then will create their own action potentials. Those action potentials will be propagated down their axons, which is a tract, right, running through the infundibulum. And when those action potentials get propagated all the way to the axon terminals, which is at the neurohypophysis, they will do what all neurons do, which is release a chemical, right? In the usual case, the chemical is a neurotransmitter, because it just diffuses a short distance away to another neuron or to a muscle, whatever tissue it's connected to, right? But in this case, it's not classified as a neurotransmitter that's released from these axon terminals in the posterior pituitary. Instead, it's classified as a neurohormone, because even though it comes out of the neuron the same way as a neurotransmitter, instead of staying there locally, it makes its way into the bloodstream and operates as a hormone. So what is this neurohormone I'm talking about specifically? There's only two that are released by the neurohypophysis. Which one am I talking about? Oxytocin, correct. So oxytocin released from those hypothalamic neurons from the neurohypophysis travels through the bloodstream back to the uterus, the same thing that stretched originally, and binds to receptors at the uterus. The uterus has the correct kind of receptors for oxytocin. The rest of the body, other than the breasts, are ignoring the oxytocin. They don't have the right receptors. But the oxytocin at the uterus responds to that oxytocin by muscular contraction. The smooth muscle that lines the wall of the uterus contracts, especially up at the fundic region, less so farther down. And so this has the effect of squeezing not just squeezing on all parts of the fetus, but squeezing on the top part so that it will pop out through the bottom. Right? Well, it's a positive feedback mechanism, though, because the more that happens, the more the head is stretching the muscle down at the cervical region, causing even more stretch receptors to fire, causing a bigger signal to the brain, causing more release of oxytocin, causing more contraction of the uterus, and so it keeps building. As the head moves farther and farther down, it stretches it more and more. Like all positive feedback mechanisms, though, it's temporary, because positive feedback mechanisms can never lead to homeostasis, right? So it's temporary in no matter what. Either it's temporary because the woman dies, and obviously it's going to stop happening, and that used to happen quite a bit. Nowadays it's temporary most often because the baby pops out, and then normal negative feedback mechanisms will take over and restore homeostasis. Well, we see the parturition mechanism operating here in cartoon form and in photographic form in slide 19, it looks like. So by the time you get to the crowning stage, basically it's the point of no return. And things will just build by the mechanism I just talked about, and in most cases, head will emerge first, followed quickly. It takes a while for the head to come through, but once that's done, then the rest slides through a lot easier. With no help, really, by the fetus. It's just basically passively allowing itself to be squirted out. It doesn't push its way out or anything like that. But, of course, throughout gestation, this fetus has been connected to the mother via the placenta. And that placenta is no longer going to be necessary in the woman, it's now going to be trash, so the placenta and associated tissues become what we call the afterbirth, which also gets expelled. And then the snip gets made, and now you officially have a baby. It's no longer a fetus. 20, I think is the last slide. What we're looking at here is surges in prolactin. Now, what is prolactin? What is it? It's a hormone, right? Now you can answer the question of what does it do? It promotes lactation, right? That's why it's called that. And remember that lactation is not the same thing as milk ejection. Milk has to be made first and stored in the mammy before it gets ejected. You don't want those things to occur at the same time, because it would be a total waste of milk if there weren't a baby's mouth there ready to receive the material. So during pregnancy, prolactin rises, but actually the pregnancy itself keeps it from creating milk. The breasts enlarge, mostly because of estrogen, but they aren't really producing milk yet. That would be a waste, too. Why start producing milk months before there's a baby? But right after birth, then the prolactin actually has its effect on the breasts and spurs on the secretion of milk from the acini that I was talking about, which are the arrangements of the glands. Well, that's what lactation is, creation of the milk to begin with. And prolactin causes that. But what is the hormone that actually causes milk ejection? Oxytocin also. So oxytocin has those two major jobs. Parturition, which is a positive feedback mechanism, and milk ejection, which actually is also a positive feedback mechanism. It's just not quite as dramatic of a positive feedback mechanism. But what is it that causes secretion of oxytocin for milk ejection? Suckling of the infant on the nipple, right. That's going to send nervous signals via neurons to the brain, releasing oxytocin. This time, it's not the uterus that responds, because the uterus has already done its job a little bit beforehand, right? The baby's already born. This time, the oxytocin finds its targets at the cells that surround these acini, the glands, and they are epithelial cells, but they're special epithelial cells that have the same sorts of structure as muscle cells do, and they therefore are able to contract. So these contractile cells, when they contract, squeeze on the acini, and that's when the milk is actually ejected from the glands through the lactiferous ducts to the nipple. And when this first starts happening, as soon as the baby starts suckling, nothing comes out right at first, because it takes a while for it to make its way all the way to the nipple. But once it does, then the infant is rewarded with continual suckling. Well, each feeding... we just talked about what happens oxytocin-wise, but feeding also produces a prolactin surge. So notice that prolactin level drastically declines after birth, but then it shoots back up every time there is nursing. Every feeding, because of the suckling on the nipple, prolactin level rises again. And this basically keeps the mother producing milk. Without the nursing, she won't continue producing milk. But as long as she's feeding, she will. Also, just coincidentally, the prolactin surges have at least somewhat of an effect on the ability to become pregnant. It's just not a reliable method of contraception. Most women are much less likely to become pregnant if they are nursing. Which makes sense evolutionarily, right? You get rid of this one before you produce another one, basically. Or let it grow up a little bit. That's what I'm saying by it not being a reliable method. It's certainly possible to become pregnant while nursing. That is it. So you now know everything there is to know about the human body. Assuming you remember the first term's worth of stuff.